Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Joining us for the half hour is international journalist, peace activist, and feminist Heather Vokusch. An American living in Austria, Heather joined us by phone for an in-depth discussion about her new book series, The Progressive's Handbook, a kind of field guide for activists. The book is available online at progressiveshandbook.com. Heather also provides audio segments for nonprofit media outlets on her webpage, heathervokusch.com. Her recent topics have included Bush family profits, the U.S. military's use of depleted uranium munitions in Iraq and Afghanistan, and holding tribunals on Bush. Here's what Heather Vokusch had to say about that topic.
While Bush administration members have made a sport of breaking the law, both domestically and internationally, their intransigence will come back to haunt, one way or another. The Bush preemptive strike doctrine, for example, is a direct repudiation of the United Nations Charter, which explains why Bush's 2002 National Security Strategy makes a point to protect Americans from the International Criminal Court. Just last week, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Chertoff accused the UN and other world bodies of using international law as a, quote, rhetorical weapon against us, unquote. Chertoff's view of international law as a threat to the U.S. is supported by Rumsfeld's 2005 National Defense Strategy, which notes, quote, our strength as a nation-state will continue to be challenged by those who employ a strategy of the weak, using international fora, judicial processes, and terrorism. Unquote. In other words, the Pentagon links judicial processes with terrorism and sees judicial processes as weakening the U.S. nation-state. I mean, what kind of nonsense is that? It's worth remembering the aftermath of World War II, when the International Military Tribunal indicted and tried over 20 Nazi leaders for war crimes, ranging from waging a war of aggression, killing civilians, mistreating prisoners, and plundering property. How eerily familiar those charges seem today. And how ominous that only weeks ago, German prosecutors began pursuing a criminal investigation into the alleged role of Rumsfeld and numerous other administration members regarding prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Rumsfeld will lose his legal immunity when he ceases to be defense secretary, a fact which must weigh heavily on Bush and others. Unsurprisingly, the administration has taken preemptive action against future war crimes charges, including pushing through the scandalous Military Commissions Act, which provides them retroactive domestic protection from prosecution regarding prisoner abuse cases. The administration has also tried to enervate the International Criminal Court, including setting up bilateral agreements which arm-twist other countries into not prosecuting U.S. nationals or foreign nationals working for the U.S. Yet such bribery will only go so far. Bottom line, as calls for impeachment build at home, Bush might heed advice he once gave to Osama bin Laden. You can run, but you cannot hide.
Heather Vokusch, you prompted me to go on the website heathervokusch.com, which is HEATHERWOKUSCH.com, and to read what you have on your front page, which happens to be right now, Impeachment Hearings for Bush and Company. How about war crimes tribunals? Give us the general gist of that piece that you've put together and what's in it.
On December 10th, we had these big actions across the country talking about impeachment hearings. But when you look at the Nuremberg principles, clearly what the Bush administration has done across the board is a crime under international law, a crime against peace, for example, waging of a war of aggression, war crimes including the wanton destruction of cities and towns, ill treatment of prisoners, crimes of humanity. And it's very interesting because the Nuremberg principles very clearly state that the head of state or responsible government official does not relieve, being the head of state or responsible government official, does not relieve you from responsibility under international law. And so I thought it was just an interesting perspective to understand that clearly the Bush administration could be seen as guilty of war crimes. Now, I don't believe that they will be charged, for example, Bush, Cheney, whoever, right now, primarily because who would charge them? Now, individuals in the EU, presumably. However, many EU governments also were complicit in these extraordinary renditions, these secret prisons, these CIA flights. And so I can't imagine that they will be rushing to bring war crimes charges. The interesting thing, though, is that there is a case in Germany right now against Rumsfeld. And the individuals who have brought this case against Rumsfeld, based on the prisoner abuse, they also have threatened to bring a similar case against him in Spain and a number of other countries, meant to educate people across the world what he has done and also just to embarrass him. It's something to think about. I can't imagine that the war crimes tribunals will actually take place, but it is something to think about, along with the fact that something that many people don't realize is that the U.S. is the only country that was condemned by the World Court for international terrorism, for the unlawful use of force. This was a case from 1986, the Republic of Nicaragua against the United States of America. And so we tend not to think of ourselves as war criminals, but when we look at the actions of our government, well, that's another case entirely.
You're talking about the mining of Nicaragua's harbors.
Yes, that's correct. And many people don't realize that the U.S. was the only country condemned by the World Court for international terrorism. You know, and so this is something that, you know, as a nation, we do need to look at our actions.
On page 112 of the Progressive's Handbook, Volume 2, Heather Vokush writes about the ulterior motives of the Bush administration. She writes, quote, "In a March 2002 meeting with Republican and Democratic senators, Bush was reportedly uninterested in discussing the different options of dealing with Saddam Hussein. As Time magazine reported in May 2002, instead he became noticeably animated, according to one person in the room used a vulgar epithet to refer to Saddam, and concluded with four words that left no one in doubt about Bush's intentions. We're taking him out, Bush said." And that was quoting Heather Vokush in Volume 2 of the Progressive's Handbook. And we should look at her pages on ulterior motives of the Bush administration in context with breaking news stories about Saddam Hussein. Under pressure from Washington, Iraq's fragmented court system has upheld a death penalty for Saddam Hussein. And it looks as though the former Iraqi dictator may be executed within weeks, an action that could spark further violence against U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians. It is yet another indication that, unchecked, Iraq policy will keep moving in a destructive direction rather than toward increased security or calm. It is all seemingly illogical, yet the ulterior motives Heather discusses center on the corporate side, on the threat posed by the fact that Iraq was positioned as a swing producer of oil prior to the invasion, something that was at odds with U.S. interests. Then there was Hussein's interest in changing currencies. He had converted Iraq's $10 billion United Nations reserve fund from dollars to euros, she explains. Iraq under Saddam Hussein was clearly moving toward dealing with Russia and France on oil. According to Vokush, Russia's Lukoil and France's Total Elf Aquitaine were among 63 companies from 30 nations in line to hit Iraq's oil jackpot. But given the history of U.S.-Iraq conflict, American companies were slated to lose big. I asked her to comment on the disparity between what many people see as a war to increase security versus a war to increase corporate profit.
From that perspective, one would logically conclude that actually the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent occupation and chaos is actually a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran and the U.S. to see who can have the most influence inevitably over OPEC and what happens to oil prices and oil availability. Just looking, for example, at the changes that Paul Bremer of the, you know, Coalition Provisional Authority pushed through in Iraq in his 1 year there, I mean, May 2003 to June 2004. He is accused of having, quote, misplaced something like $33 billion of Iraq's own money for reconstruction. So in and of itself, that's just so egregious. But Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority illegally restructured Iraq's economic system to essentially open it up to foreign business. Now, without adequate input from the Iraqi people, he just unilaterally annulled the rules and regulations that had governed Iraq's economy. Now, this is illegal to change a nation's basic law during a belligerent occupation. The 1907 Hague regulations ban it. You can't do that. But that's exactly what Bremer did. His most egregious act, one would say, was to push through something called 100 orders. And these fundamentally changed Iraq's legal system, essentially making it more convenient for foreign business to operate in Iraq and take the profits out. Order 39 allows Iraq's state-owned businesses to be privatized. Now, this did not include oil, but of course James Baker and his recent acts is working on including oil as well. It permits 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi businesses and 40-year ownership licenses and unrestricted remittance of profits, for example. Order 17 gives foreign contractors immunity from Iraq's laws. And so it just goes through, across the board, 100 orders that makes it easier for foreign corporations to take over Iraq. This is a precedent that we have set, and it clearly is disgraceful.
Heather, we've been hearing reports about the so-called Salvador option in Iraq, and journalist Dar Jamail filled us in on some of the grim details, U.S. involvement with the death squads in Iraq, a story that has leaked out here and there thanks to courageous reporters like him and others, but it's still not what we would call a mainstream story. Now, you mentioned the Salvador option in your book and provide some links to reports on this. Just talk about the fact that in 2005, Newsweek reported that the Pentagon was looking at a proposal to send special forces teams to advise, support, and possibly train Iraqi squads, most likely hand-picked Kurdish Peshmerga fighters and Shiite militiamen, to, quote, target Sunni insurgents and their sympathizers even across the border into Syria. And now today we see death squads. Did we see at the time that that 2005 Newsweek story was written the formation of the death squads?
I believe we probably saw it way before then, but this is when it came to light. And again, the very concept of the U.S. actually being involved in something like that, again, would relate back to the Bush perspective on the world, and that is that you are with us or you are against us, and it doesn't matter. If you're against us, then we will use whatever it is that it takes to bring you into submission, I guess, if we could use these words. And so from that rather skewed perspective, one would argue that the concept of a death squad would be acceptable, much in the same way that it was, for example, for, you know, Reagan, Negroponte, whoever. But for American people, I mean, the concept that we would actually be involved in abductions and executions and, you know, abuse of that nature is just shocking. Even today, you know, you constantly hear the news that some people dressed in Iraqi police uniforms, you know, kidnapped and murdered how many people? Well, you know, they probably are actually police, and they, you know, in many instances, they probably are funded actually by the U.S. And so it clearly is a very ugly element of war. And one that is taking place, one would argue, even today.
We're speaking with Heather Vokush, author of The Progressive's Handbook, a series that provides a journalist's history into the full impact of Bush administration policy. In terms of the environment, we learn about the U.S. military's use of depleted uranium in Iraq and Afghanistan. And on America, Heather turns her attention to mountaintop mining, the Clear Skies Initiative, or as she puts it, past the inhaler, Clear Skies, Black Lungs. There is a section called Superfund Rest in Peace, and various others, one on contaminated military bases, one on nuclear plants, one on backroom deals, and more. And then there are Heather's trademark 10 Easy Ways to Make a Difference Now. This is part reference material for teachers and activists and part inspirational list, something to keep us from feeling hopeless. For those who are wondering why we've seen so many outbreaks of E. coli, there's a possible answer in Heather's section on the environment. On page 55 of Volume 2 of the Progressive's Handbook, we learn that one of the Bush administration's first acts in office was to freeze the EPA's proposal for stronger standards on U.S. sewage systems treatment. As a result, Vokush writes, over a trillion gallons of untreated sewage entered American waterways in the following 4 years. And in 2003, she writes, water treatment plants were allowed to discharge sewage, which hadn't been treated for disease-causing pathogens. The next time you take a dip, writes Heather Vokush, you could have E. coli bacteria, the hepatitis A virus, or Giardia protozoa swimming right along next to you. I asked Heather to talk about one of her suggestions, which is to learn about Superfund sites and other kinds of environmental problems that are local.
It's all around the general theme of taking it personally. When we think of global warming, for example, it seems like this kind of broad-based thing that somehow is affecting Eskimos, but we don't tend to take it personally unless we see Al Gore's film or really look at these issues as affecting our lives. And so each of these 10 points elucidates ways in which we can more clearly understand how the changes in the environment really do affect us. You know, it really does affect our health, it affects our lives, it affects the future of our children. And so at the end of each of these chapters, it's various ways in which we can take these things personally, but then once we have taken them personally, do something about it. And as you had mentioned, for example, to identify the toxicity in your community. In the Weapons of Mass Destruction chapter, I say how you can identify if, in fact, there are horrible facilities building biological weapons or nuclear weapons in your neighborhood. I think that's the first step, because often we do have these things in our neighborhood and we don't even know about it.
On page 39 in your chapter on elections and voting, you bring it down to how money, big money, controls U.S. politics, and the only question is how to stop that. And you have all kinds of important facts in here, and I just want to mention a few of them. The 2000 presidential campaign of George Bush, the Republican National Committee, and then Governor Bush were the lucky recipients of over $200 million of special interest cash, and you spell that out as $20.7 million from energy interests, $15.1 million from the healthcare industry, $14.6 million from agribusiness, and $13.9 million from auto manufacturers and other transportation interests. Talk about that part of your book that has to do with this huge, huge economic impact on our democracy.
And indeed, this goes back to what we were talking about before with the media. For example, here in Austria, you don't need to raise so much money because you don't have to buy television ads. And the amount of other kind of advertising that you can buy is highly regulated. And so we first need to look at our election system and the way that it really has become corrupt in so many ways, but certainly the fact that it is votes for sale. Now, in relation to the facts that you just said there with this $200 million of special interest cash, what it goes on to say is how individuals from each of these interests, be they energy interests or the healthcare or agribusiness, what have you, individuals from those lobbying areas were then dutifully appointed to Bush's transition team and given power over the country's agenda. And so it is a way in which corporations clearly have bought their way into the U.S. electoral system. I wonder if you remember in 2004, a gentleman named Dr. Lawrence Britt looked at the different fascist regimes, Hitler, Germany, Mussolini, Italy, what have you, and he identified 14 defining characteristics that were common to each of these. The interesting thing is that this list of 14 characteristics absolutely describe what is going on in the United States. And as I recall, one of them was fraudulent elections. Another was rampant cronyism. And another was that corporate power is protected. For example, business aristocracy and the industrial aristocracy are the ones who put the government leaders into power, creating this mutually beneficial relationship. And I believe that's shown nowhere more beautifully than in these, you know, the numbers of the donations to the campaigns, and then to see who actually gets appointed to these jobs later on.
And you're talking about the 14 defining characteristics of fascism, right? Dr. Lawrence Britt, and that's still available online, I believe, at Rents. We're talking with Heather Vokush. Let's turn to a few of the people that you're speaking about when you cite individuals, because I found it fascinating that you've listed people like Jeffrey Homestead, who became the EPA's air administrator after being a lawyer for electric utilities, oil industry lobbyist Stephen Grills, who became Deputy Secretary of Interior, and let's not forget timber industry lobbyist Mark Ray, who became head of the Forest Service. These are big perks for individuals who, you know, contributed either time or promotion, if you will, for the Bush administration and for Republicans.
Indeed. But and just across the board, the individuals who were promoted or appointed to various jobs within the EPA or what have you are just so shocking. In the environment chapter, I had whole sections talking about, here's a bull in the china shop, I called it, and here's another one, here's another one, because it was just so shocking how many completely inappropriate individuals were appointed to various areas. One of my favorites was the gentleman who was appointed to protect animals, essentially, for the whole Endangered Species Act. And he actually had been a representative from this extreme hunting association that hunted endangered species, for example. And this is the gentleman who's supposed to be protecting our endangered species. And so clearly, one way to do it is you just stock these important committees and what have you with people who are going to be working against the main cause for that committee, be it parks, be it animals, be it air, be it whatever. And this is one of the reasons that we've had so many rollbacks in the environment in the United States, but that people don't know about it because the people who would have complained have been fired.
I want to talk about the chapter on voting a little bit more, because at the end of that chapter, after telling us how important voting is and all of the things that can happen if we're not in control of elections and the campaigning of these politicians and what they're telling us, then you talk about how we can have more of a say about how our elections are run, how our voting machines are selected and used and monitoring them and all of that. Talk about that part of your book on how people can play a big role in starting to take an interest in how the elections in their own hometowns and home states are run.
And I would say that this issue is even more important after the midterms. Many people think that, oh, well, the Democrats won, so everything must be fine. But this could not be further from the truth. There were more complaints regarding the electronic voting machines, for example, in this election. The at least Common Cause noted that there were more complaints in this election than they had received in 2004. And one could also argue that many of the electronic voting machine tricks that had been used in years past weren't used in this election. They're going to be saved for 2008. And so it's important that we not become, and our representatives not become, complacent in the face of the midterms. But for example, in relation to voting machines, I list websites that you can go to, primary being Black Box Voting, for example, ways that you can contact your own Secretary of State and to find out, is your name on the state's voting list for the people who are not allowed to vote? Does your state have paper trails, for example? And who owns the machines, the voting machines that are used in your state? These are questions that we should be able to ask, and clearly we should be able to get decent answers too. There is a section on how to increase women's power in the political process. But I think that a main thing is just to look at the money behind elections. There are some amazing sites, for example, opensecrets.org, that it's laid out so beautifully. One section you can click on is who gives, and another section is who gets. And so you can see what corporations fund your candidates, what corporations fund Bush, Cheney, whatever like that. And so it's very interesting information that we aren't usually privy to.
Heather Vokush, talk about what listeners can do immediately to inspire themselves into action.
We spoke before about this strict father family and the damage that it has done. This is one model, and we spoke also about Lakoff's idea of the nurturant parent family with the ideals of freedom and community building and open two-way communication, trust, for example. And so I think that the most important place to start is to look inside one's own heart and soul and define which family structure, to continue the metaphor, do I think is appropriate for my country. And if it isn't this strict father thing, if it's more along the idea of the nurturant parent family, then that means that each of us has the responsibility to nurture not only ourselves through getting good information and through being very careful that we don't land in apathy or political burnout because of all the bad news. So first to nurture ourselves, to find active ways to get involved. And then second, nurturance means that you have to reach out to other people. It's the responsibility of saying, okay, I am going to use this two-way communication. I'm going to tell people what I've learned. I'm going to be of service to my community and really get some of this information out, because I understand that the ultimate goal is more freedom and indeed a better society for all of us. So that's getting a bit grandiose perhaps towards the end, but I believe that just the smallest actions that one takes to nurture one's own information and inspiration, and the smallest actions that one takes for other people, also can add up to a huge difference. Now, what I would like to invite anybody listening on a personal level is to visit the website for the books. It's called progressiveshandbook.com. That's progressiveshandbook.com. Part of this is something called an action center. And I put this up there for those days that you're just feeling bummed out and you just need a little inspiration and lift. And it has everything ranging from people that I find inspiring. For example, this month, one of the people is a young Iranian woman talking about what it's like to live there. And if you have anything that you would like to add to the Action Center, any great quotes or people that you think are especially inspiring, then write me, let me know, and then we will add it to the site. So let's do what we can through online and also within our own communities to connect and just make sure that we, whatever family system, again, that our country has, is one that we approve of and that we believe is the best one in order to take our country for the next years to come.
Heather, thank you for joining us.
And I thank you so much for having me on the show. It was wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
And just a reminder for those who want to get active by participating in the January 27th March on Washington to demand that Congress make good on the peace mandate and bring troops home from Iraq. You can contact UnitedForPeace.org or your local office of the American Friends Service Committee. The national website is afsc.org, and they're helping to coordinate buses. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced in the studios of WHUS, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org or TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio links, and discussions. Our music is by composer and musician Fritz Heed. His webpage is fritzheed.com, F-R-I-T-Z-H-E-E-D-E.com.